Open your Bibles to Zechariah chapter 10 tonight. Zechariah chapter 10. Just to kind of keep us on track, the structure of the book of Zechariah, the first chapters of the book have a series, if you remember, a series of visions that Zechariah sees that are looking at the circumstances that they find themselves in, what God is going to do with these returned exiles that are in the process of building rebuilding the temple, and then future promises that he has for them. That then led into chapters 7 and 8, in which there was a question about fasting, which we dealt with a couple weeks ago. They wanted to know whether they were supposed to continue with the fasting that they had been doing. And we dealt with that the fasting was not appropriate. It was appropriate if they were in a state of unrighteousness. Then they could fast over their unrighteous activities. Then we came down last week. We went through chapter 9, in which we had kind of an extended section on Israel under the Greeks. The first part of it in what was going to happen under Alexander the Great when he came through the land. Although he's not mentioned, but it is exactly what happened when he went through the land. God just talks about it in terms of what's going to take place and then all these other nations around them that are falling. What God was going to do is he was going to use Alexander the Great to judge these nations that had been a problem to Israel, but Israel would be spared. And then at the end of that chapter, he deals with another man that is dealt with in Daniel 11, and that was Antiochus Epiphanes, who was a Greek leader after the Grecian Empire had been broken up. We looked at him last week, especially in Daniel and the things that he put the people of Israel through. Now we come into tonight, into chapter 10, and he is going to look at promises that are both near and far. Near for the immediate exiles that are there, and then some of these looking off into the distance. And so we put in at verse 1, it says, "Ask rain from the Lord," that is from Jehovah, "at the time of the spring rain, the Lord who makes the storm clouds, and he will give them showers of rain, vegetation in the field to each man." Now he's contrasting this to the thing that had gotten them into trouble. In verse 2, they'd gotten themselves into trouble because they turned to other gods. And we've seen plenty of that in the minor prophets. Hosea, that was one of the biggest issues in Hosea, was that God looked at himself as having married these two sisters, Judah and Israel. And both of them had run off. And he pictured it through Hosea marrying a woman that ended up prostituting herself to other men. And then what Hosea lavished on her in goods, she attributed to these other men, which is exactly what Israel did. They attributed God's blessings as coming from these false gods. And so he rehearses what had happened in their history and reminds them for the teraphim. Now the teraphim were small household idols. These are what Rachel took with her when Jacob left with Rachel and Leah. They left the household of Laban. Remember, she took them and she hid them in the saddlebag and took them with her. So she takes the little household idols. Now, part of the teraphim. So those were so you had your big gods that were on top of hills and in temples and things, but you also normally had little idols that you kept in your house. That's what teraphim were. And it says they speak perversity. And the diviners, those were the people, this was a term that actually was used for people that killed animals and then took their entrails and would throw them out of the ground and then would look at the entrails to determine the future, to divine the future. It says they see lying visions. They tell false dreams. And they comfort in vain. And the word in vain is like vapor. So you think about like a cold morning when you go out and you breathe and it comes out and looks substantial, it just disappears. Sunday night, smoke's a little different than vapor, but it's similar. Peg and I walked out Sunday evening to take our walk, and somebody was burning something in that wind at the top of the hill, and the wind drove it down, and as it got down, it all settled down over the downtown area. So it's just this thick black smoke down there. But after we'd been out for a half hour, the wind kept blowing it away, and it cleared that smoke out. And the smoke was still coming from up there, but it cleared it out. So it's temporary. It's the idea. So he says, they comfort in vain. Their comfort's just like that vapor. It looks like it might have some substance, but there's nothing to it. It says, therefore, the people, they wander like sheep. So in other words, the very things that the people resorted to get help, the teraphims and the diviners, they're no help. He says in verse 3, my anger is kindled against the shepherds. Shepherds being the religious leaders of Israel, priests in particular, that should have been helping them. Now, it could be political rulers, because remember, David is said to be a shepherd. So it can also refer to them. But then it goes on here and it says, and I will punish the male goats. Now, this term is used several times in the Old Testament for leaders of people, and it can refer, could refer to their leaders, but more likely than not, it's referring to non-Israeli or non-Judean rulers that have come in and are using their influence on the people. So the people kind of turn to them. It'd be like people in our United States being more concerned about what the UN thinks than what our elected officials here. You have no say in what goes on with the UN. And yet they would influence us, and so you could care less about the president you elected or your senators and such like. Well, that's what these people. They're not your rulers. They're the male goats, but you follow them around. And the significance of the male goat is that unlike a ram is a protector of a flock, but sheep do not have the tendency of being bright animals. Goats, on the other hand, have a tendency of being a critter that's a bit smarter. And they actually can train goats to lead sheep. But you don't use any goat, you use a male goat in particular. And you put a male goat out there and he will lead, he'll follow the sheep. And in fact, traditionally, when they would slaughter sheep, the way they'd get the sheep to come up there to where they were going to slaughter them was they would use a male goat, and that's why they called them a scapegoat, a Judas goat. They called it a Judas goat, because it would actually lead the sheep and the sheep would follow it. And so he's comparing these leaders.
Would this be their kings or their religious leaders within the, or both?
I would take it to be foreign kings and foreign religious leaders that they potentially, and which thing is, both of those happened to Israel in their past. In the past, Israel had problems with both listening to foreign kings as well as being involved with foreign religious leaders or foreign religions. And so it's both of them. He's concerned both for their shepherds, and he's going to punish the male goats. For the Lord of hosts, as Jehovah, has visited, and remember when we have hosts, that means armies. Okay, so the Lord of armies, which makes sense because in the context he's talking about punishing them. Okay. The Lord of hosts and has visited his flock, the house of Judah, to make them like the majestic horse in battle. So you can imagine you take horses, or sheep, excuse me, and you make them become battle horses. You know, I always think of Cinderella, you know, where the fairy godmother waves over the mice and boom, they turn into these great big horses or something like that. Well, that's what he says here. I'm going to take you, your sheep, I'm going to make you battle horses. You know, you wouldn't expect that. Okay, were you going to comment?
Well, I have a question. It says no shepherd, and then it says my anger is kindled against the shepherds. Is that just the reason for
I think the reason he says it's kindled against the shepherds because there is no shepherd, meaning the people that should be leading them aren't leading them.
And so it's major league shepherds or
No. It would be like 1 Peter 5. Where Peter has to say, the elders that are among you, shepherd the church of God. In other words, you got people with the pastor teacher gift, but they won't use it for the sheep. Because they're afraid to use it. That was the situation of Peter's day. So they were there among the believers, they had a pastor teacher gift, but they don't want to lead with the pastor teacher gift. They don't want to do it. Here's the situation where there are people, there were priests that he's talking about, but they don't want to be priests. They don't want to be the shepherds. They don't want that job. or they're not doing the job. Maybe they're going through the motions of the job, but they don't actually do the job. They don't really provide the direction they're supposed to be providing. Okay? In other words, God shouldn't have to be warning Israel through Zechariah the prophet. Who should be doing it? The priest should be saying, you guys, what are you doing? You shouldn't be doing this. This isn't the way it should be done. Okay? To use an example, we have a Bible conference here, but one of the things we don't have in our church, we don't have revivals. And I grew up around churches that thought you had to have revivals. You bring in an outdoor speaker to get you all wound up and pumped up. Why? Because no one hears encouraging you, challenging you to do the right thing. If that's the case, then somebody in the church isn't doing their job. Because the people in the church should be encouraging people to do what the right things are. And if you have to bring somebody else in like that to do that, then that's kind of like saying, well, you know, we got to bring an outsider in because you guys aren't doing it yourself. That would be a bad thing. It's one of the reasons we don't do that, because I think we have people that do encourage you to do the right thing. And we do challenge you on a regular basis in how you're living your Christian life. And we do warn you. It's there. Okay. Verse 4. He goes on. For from them will come the cornerstone. Not everybody agrees on this fact, but I think he's making a reference to the Messiah. Because the Messiah is the one that in Isaiah is called the cornerstone. Okay. Okay. And it says, and from them the tent peg. Now I'm going to give you three interpretations on the tent peg, and I'm going to tell you which one of these I think is, there's others, but one of them is, because all this word means is peg. It doesn't mean tent peg. It's just a peg or a stake. One of the places you know that is in one of the passages that I would refer to on this is in Judges 4, okay, where Jael, remember Sisera, the general, Sisera comes and runs to the tent. She says, come on in here, and he gives her some water, and he lays down, and he's going to hide, and she takes, it says, the peg here of an ahel. An ahel is a tent. So you have to use the word tent with the word peg or stake. So the word does not mean tent peg in and of itself. It just means stake or peg. That one happened to be one for the tent, because it's in a construct state with the word tent right after it. Like we have tent peg. Except theirs would be peg tent in the Hebrew. And she takes and drives it through his head. Now that's one of the interpretations. I think this is the significance of this. When he's talking about, he's going to be, the Messiah is going to come from them, the cornerstone. Number two, it says that there will be from them the tent peg. And as they could be the one through which God's going to administer this judgment and this justice, just like it was driven through the temple of Sisera. Now that's a possibility. One other commentator takes it that it's a peg put in the wall on which God hangs his glory. I'm not so sure about that one. That seems a little strange. It also could be a reference to the tent peg that held up a tent, because what did God originally dwell in among the people of Israel? A tent. And it was a peg for a tent in that regard that was used in Sisera. So it may have a dual reference. I think it probably, because he's looking a little bit at what he's going to do in battle. First of all, you got the cornerstone, which is the foundation. It's the thing that squares up and everything for the temple. That's the Messiah. And he's the one that leads the charge. The second one, I really think that there's the picture of the tent peg being driven through the temple of Sisera, because it is indeed the same word. Okay. And then lastly, and from the bow of battle. And if you remember back in, let's see, need to find it here. Back in chapter 9, in verse 13, God referred to Ephraim as a bow that he bends. So here he is actually bowing or bending Israel like a bow for battle. And from them, then, every ruler of them together. So he's looking at this people Israel that are wandering sheep because you guys aren't doing it. He says, there's a time coming in the future in which I'm actually going to bring the Messiah out of these people. Now, this is being written about 520. So that's not going to happen for another almost 520 years. And he's born Savior. He's born Christ the Lord, but he actually doesn't become Christ because he's not really anointed until his baptism, which is around probably around 26 or 27 AD. Okay, so we're looking at 540 years later. So that's off in the future. And was Israel going to become a tent peg, a bow of battle, and rulers coming from those people, from Israel? Was that going to happen during Christ's earthly ministry? No. So that actually, I believe, is even yet in the future further in terms of what he's going to do. Verse 5, they will be as mighty men, treading down the enemy in the mire of the streets of battle. They will fight for the Lord and be with them. The riders on horses will be put to shame. I shall strengthen the house of Judah, and I shall, this is important now, I shall save the house of Joseph. Joseph had two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. Ephraim became the tribe that was associated with what went on in the north. Manasseh is also associated at times, but Ephraim in particular. In fact, we just read about Ephraim. We just made reference back to Ephraim in 9:13. And so what's he looking at? If he's looking at Judah and the house of Joseph, what other event has to take place in here? There has to be a reunification of the north and the south. And the north has to come back from their captivity. Has the north come back from their captivity? Not even in our day it hasn't yet. Judah was the only one sent into exile that brought back those that went into the Assyrian captivity. Never have returned. So this definitely is yet future. Even from our point of view, this is still future. And I will bring them back because I have compassion on them. This is one of the words that Jim was referencing on Sunday morning, rakam. It was a term, your Bible's used to translate this mercy. And mercy is not a bad translation because it's translated by a word mercy in the New Testament. It meant soft. And in fact, it actually referred to the womb. It's actually the word for womb, but it also meant mercy because it was a soft place, a place of softness and tenderness and care. And they will be as though I had not rejected them, implying he had rejected them. Now, stop and think about this. Was Judah rejected at the moment that Zechariah is prophesying? No. They had been rejected. They'd been sent into Babylon. They'd been brought back. The exiles have returned. So they're not rejected at this moment in time, are they? So they're not rejected. And he says, so they will be as though I had not rejected them. Indicating, again, he's looking at a future time in which they're going to be rejected again. He's implying another future rejection. For I am the Lord their God, and I will answer them. And Ephraim, again looking at the north, will be like a mighty man. Their heart will be glad as if from wine. Indeed, their children will see it and be glad. Their heart will rejoice in the Lord. And I will whistle for them together, for them to gather them together. For I have redeemed them, and they will be as numerous as they were before. When I scatter them among the peoples, then they will remember me in far countries, and they with their children will live and come back. I mean, he's implying in this prophecy, whether these people see it or not, another future scattering among the peoples. These are exiles. Haven't been back really in time that long from the Babylonian captivity. And he's already indicating there's another future scattering that's coming. I will bring them back from the land of Egypt. Is he really bringing them back from the land of Egypt? Well, there's a possibility in a literal sense that they are scattered and some of them end up in Egypt. Okay, so that's a possibility. But it's also that he's using Egypt as a metaphor for a place of what? Captivity. Because even more than Babylon, Egypt was associated with the slavery that Israel had undergone for 400 years. Which they hadn't undergone. In Babylon? No, 70 years. Babylon and Persia. That was the extent of it. And then he goes, and I will gather them from Assyria. Now in 520, let's see if I can, this is one of those places where I definitely need to get my, I have to look at my notes because I need the date. Okay. This is being, I'm trying to get this. This is being written in 520. So he's writing 520. You go back on the calendar, Nineveh and the Assyrian Empire, they began their fall in 612. So you're looking back 92 years in time that you're going back. Assyria hasn't been a power for close to 90 years. So how can he regather them from Assyria if Assyria, again, if Assyria isn't around, how can they be gathered from Assyria? Because Assyria is a metaphor for the place where they're scattered. Well, think about it. When the Assyrian Empire went down, were all those people that had been scattered in beginning in... remember, the Assyrian captivity began back here in 722 BC. So we're going back another 110 years earlier. Did all those people that were scattered then just come back when the Assyrian Empire fell? No. Maybe some of them did, but we have no record that they did. Nothing that tells us they did. They stayed out scattered among those peoples. And you can read about where they were scattered if you go over to 2 Kings or read 2 Chronicles. So he goes on and he says, and I will bring them into the land of Gilead and Lebanon until, notice it, no room can be found for them. In other words, there's going to be so many that are going to come back into captivity. We won't be able to find a place for them. Which again is a reminder that what happened in back in the 40s over in modern day is not this event. I don't know that anybody says it is, but there are some people that think that what happened back then is at least the fulfillment of what happened over in Ezekiel. And it can't be. This is an indication here. When they come back, there's going to be so many of them. Listen, it was a small number that returned to the land. And even today, it's still a small number. They're surrounded by so many other peoples. And the land isn't packed full of them. Verse 11, and they will pass through the Sea of Distress. In other words, just as they came out of Egypt, they passed through the Red Sea. But this is a sea of adversity. And strike the waves in the sea, so that all the depths of the Nile will dry up. The Nile was the pride of Egypt. I mean, Israel's whole livelihood depended on the Nile. They were an agricultural society that survived on the fact that it rained in the mountain, rained to the south of them, the river flowed north and flooded their plains so that they could farm and deposited all that rich silt. And without that, they would have nothing. The Nile dries up. And the pride of Assyria will be brought down. The pride of Assyria was Nineveh. And again, going back up here, Zechariah, we're reading that Zechariah's right at 520. Assyria fell back here. Assyria fell back here 90 some years earlier. So how can the pride of Assyria fall if it's already fallen? Again, he's speaking in metaphor that these people could understand and appreciate about future nations that they don't know yet. They don't know about these nations. They don't know who the Romans are. 520, the Romans are not a people. I was actually listening to a history of Hannibal and his father, Hamilcar Barca, in Carthage, and the people of Sicily and over there in Spain and all this. And one of the things you find out is it is not, it's going to be a couple hundred years yet before you even begin to have Rome begin emerging as an actual people over there in Italy that become, should be taken seriously. You're at a point in time here in which Carthage in North Africa is still a significant power. So how can he mention the people Rome? Carthage is not going to be the problem for Israel. It's going to end up being Rome not only in 70 AD, but ultimately in the future. Future from our point even. From where we are today. The Rome is going to be the issue.
So where did Jonah in the timeline? What year did Jonah prophesy?
Jonah, this falls in 612, and we believe that Jonah prophesies about 100 years, maybe a little over 100 years before Nineveh falls. Because they repented, and it was about another 100 years later that Nineveh actually then came under God's judgment and fell.
It was the next generation, so that could have been...
Well, it was about 100 years, though. It was about 100 years afterwards that Nineveh fell. It could have been, yeah. Excuse me. Exactly. And it says, and the scepter of Egypt will depart, and I will strengthen them in the Lord, and in his name they will walk, declares the Lord. So, all of this is referring to a time in the future in which Israel is going to come back in restoration. And it is implied in this context that when that happens, these are people that are going to be scattered. So he's implying another scattering. It's very important for us to understand that. Now, if we understand that that's a scattering, then that also helps us if we go back very quickly then to the end of verse 2 when it says, they are afflicted because there is no shepherd, and my anger is kindled against their shepherds. Is he looking at their immediate time? Was this the problem then? No, because in reality, they had a righteous priest that was leading them, and they had a righteous leader, Zerubbabel. So they've got Zerubbabel, and they've got Joshua, the son of Jehoiakim. They've got a good leader and a good priest. So again, this is looking at another time in the future in which those shepherds that should be shepherding aren't going to be shepherding. And they're going to resort to bad shepherds, wrong shepherds, shepherds that are male goats rather than real shepherds. Okay. That will potentially lead them astray. And remember, Jesus Christ, when he predicts the Daniel 70th week in the future, he said, watch out, because there'll be false prophets. And there are going to be people that are going to go, oh, it's over here. He's come over here. He's over here in this inner room. No, he's out in the desert. And he says, don't run out after them. The coming of the Son of Man isn't going to be a secret thing. It's going to be something everybody's going to see. It's different than the rapture. I don't know who's going to see or witness the rapture. I know I will. But I don't know if unsaved people will witness that. But everybody is going to see the second coming. Okay. And Jesus warned them. In fact, Jesus said the deception is going to be so incredible during Daniel's 70th week. He says that if it were possible, even the elect could be deceived. It's going to be that convincing of a deception. Which doesn't surprise me, because today Christians can be deceived from, sometimes the things that Christians tell me, and I'm going, but the Word of God says, oh, but this person said this. And I'm like, yeah, but the Word of God. And so Christians can be deceived today, and they can be, because Paul warns against deception several times. Christians can be deceived today. It wouldn't surprise me that the elect of Israel could be deceived in the future. Now we put in chapter 11 very quickly then. It says, so open your doors, O Lebanon, that a fire may feed on your cedars. Wail, O cypress, from the cedar, for the cedar has fallen, because the glorious trees have been destroyed. Wail, O oaks of Bashan, for the impenetrable forces come down. There is a sound of the shepherd's wail, for their glory is ruined. There is a sound of the young lion's roar, for the pride of the Jordan is ruined. So here he is looking at judgment on the leaders of Israel. And I believe judgment on the leaders of Israel in a future time, not judgment of the leaders immediately in the days of Zechariah. Now, there's different ways of looking at what you have, because you have in the context here, you have the temple, or excuse me, you have trees, then you have the shepherds, and then you have the young lions. Okay, so you can look at those as three different groupings of the leaders in Israel. Number one, the trees. I'm giving you one interpretation of this, that the trees are representing the nobles, okay, nobility.
Where's the trees?
That's in verse 1 and 2, where you have the cedars, the cypress, the glorious trees, the oaks of Bashan, penetrable forest. Then you have the shepherds that are wailing. Those are supposed to be the religious leaders. And then you have at the end of verse 3, or in the middle of it, I guess you might say, the sound of the young lions. Those would be their political rulers. So there's a possibility involved in that this is what you have. There's also the possibility that in the first set, that the trees are a reference to the temple. Now, I have a friend that teaches that he believes that the reference of the different trees are related to the trees because they were different wood was used in the temple. But I think that these are references to three different levels of leadership within the people of Israel. And that we'll come back to this idea in just a minute. Verse 4. Thus says the Lord my God, pasture the flock doomed to slaughter. Now this is important. Notice what it says. Thus says the Lord my God. Pasture or shepherd the flock that is to the slaughter. In other words, these sheep are being led to the slaughter, but I'm asking you to shepherd them. Could you imagine feeding sheep as you're leading them into the slaughterhouse? But that's what he says, this is what this is akin to. Now, who's he talking to when he says shepherd the flock? Are you talking to Zechariah?
The worthless shepherds.
Well, we're gonna see who it is here in just a minute.
The foolish.
I believe this is a reference to the Messiah. And you're going to see why here in just a minute. If we stopped here, you wouldn't know. But he presses on. Those who buy them, slay them, go unpunished. Each of those who sell them says, blessed be the Lord, for I have become rich, and their own shepherds have no pity on them. Now, I believe what he's looking at in verse 5 is a time in which the people of Judah are going to treat other people of Judah with just such disdain. They have so little care for them that they sell them. And notice what they say, bless the Lord. Now, so I don't think the Romans are going to say, bless Jehovah, because that's what the word Lord is there. Notice it's all capital letters. They're not going to say, bless is Jehovah, for I have become rich. Who's going to give account to Jehovah? The people of Israel. And what he's saying is people of Israel are going to make themselves rich off the people of Israel. That's what he's looking at.
Like the priest taking advantage of the weak and the widows and all that.
Exactly. Exactly. Okay. And as a result, it says, and even their own shepherds have no pity. So the ones that actually should be looking out for the flock, they're doing nothing for the sheep when they're being sold like this, being led to the slaughter. Verse 6, for I shall no longer have pity on the inhabitants of the land, declares the Lord. So here's a coming of time. In contrast to what we just looked at in verse 10, where he's bringing them back, now he's looking at a time where he, God, has no pity. He has no mercy on these people that are in the land, declares the Lord. But behold, I shall cause the men to fall, each one to another's power, and into the power of his king. Well, let's keep going. And they will strike the land, and I shall not deliver them from their power. Now, when he talks about this, I'm going to deliver them each into his own hand. He's looking again at a time in the future in which the people are going to turn against each other. In which the people are going to have such a callous disregard for one another that they each man is against, as it says there, another's power. And the Lord's going to turn them over to the power of his king, these people. Now, who's the king at this time? When this is happening? Well, you don't know what the time frame is. Let's think of a time in which Israel has a king, but they denounce their king. And they claim another king. Can you think of an instance in which Israel did that?
They got Saul.
Okay.
They rejected God as king and they wanted an earthly king.
Okay.
But they.
Let's think of another time.
They rejected Christ and they said Caesar's our king.
Okay. And I went looking for that again, and I thought that'd be in Matthew 27, but it's not. Even when I went there, I was going, no, this isn't John. No, Matthew's the gospel about the king. It'd be there. It's in John, of all places. And it's in John 18, or John 19, where Christ is to be crucified, and Jesus brings him out. He says, behold your king. And the high priests say, we have no king. We have no king but Caesar. And what in the end is Caesar, or the king of Rome, what's he eventually going to do? He's going to actually turn on these people. So he turns them over to the power of his king, and they then, power of the other, power of the king, they will strike the land, and I will deliver them from their power. In other words, God's going to let them go through this. He's going to let them experience this. So we're in verse 6 of chapter 11. So verse 7, so I pastured the flock that was to the slaughter, hence the afflicted of the flock. And the afflicted here is the oni. We went over this word last year when we were looking at the issue of possessions and living life. And the oni are those who are pressed down. Oftentimes those who are the widows, the orphans, and the poor, and they're pressed down by the upper class, the people that have pressed down, take advantage of these. And so he says, I pasture the flock, the slaughter, and then he brings it in here. What he's really doing is he's taking care of those who are afflicted. In other words, if he is going to shepherd, he's going to shepherd those who actually are really getting the short end of the deal altogether. And I took for myself two staffs, the one that I called favor, or literally pleasantness, because Israel was a pleasant thing when they were in the land, and union, because they were supposed to be united in the land. And so I pastored the flock. And then I annihilated. Now, verse 8 is important. Then I annihilated the three shepherds in 1 month, for my soul was impatient with them, and their soul was weary with me. Now, notice, this is the one that's shepherding. This isn't Zechariah. This is another one. And who's the one that destroys three shepherds? Now, here's the whole question. When I went through this in seminary, my professor told us, and I've got this written in my notes, and so I wrote it down in here when I was looking back over my notes, there are over 40 different interpretations of who these three shepherds are. Over 40 different interpretations. But I'm going to tell you who I think it is. Okay? Now, granted, this is one interpretation out of over 40. Therefore, I mean, there's a good chance I could be wrong. But I think this makes sense in the context. If you went back to verses 1 through 3, we have God's judgment. We have the problem with the trees and the fire and the forest. We have the sound in verse 3 of the wailing shepherds. And we have the sound of the young lions. And I believe that Israel had three groups that were involved in being religious leaders at the time. In verse 3.
Okay.
Israel had three groups of leaders. And I'm not going to tell you that this is absolutely exactly the way it is, but here's a possibility. We have the trees, which we said is comparable to the nobility. Okay? Then the trees, we have the shepherds, which come straight across. And then the young lions, which are most likely, here like this, most likely the political leaders of Israel. Now, all of these come across the three groups that you and I know. You wouldn't have known it in the time Zechariah's right, but I think most of the people that listened to Zechariah or read Zechariah's prophecy, whatever the case may be, they wouldn't have known this at that time. They didn't know how this would be fulfilled. But the political leaders in Israel at that time were the Sadducees, and I don't know if I'm spelling this right. I don't know if there's two C's in there, but Sadducees. Okay. The shepherds were the priests. We've already seen that in the previous context. And the trees, the nobility, would have been reference to the Pharisees. And all three of these groups play a part in rejecting the Messiah. All three of them play a part in rejecting the king, and all three of them are going to come under the judgment of God when God judges Israel in 70 AD. Because it destroys the temple. Now the priests, no matter what they do, they can't really serve. The Sadducees no longer have a nation over it. The Sadducees were the ones that were trying to guard the religious aspects of what we're doing here in their connection with politics. These were the ones that were aligned with Herod. Okay. The Pharisees were the ones that were trying to guard the law, but these were the ones, if you remember, that Jesus says, we're going to look at that in just a second. They loaded burdens on people's back. Flip over there for a second to Matthew chapter 23, just to be reminded what Jesus says about the Pharisees here. The Sadducees, remember, the Sadducees were an interesting bunch. They would be comparable in Christianity to modern-day Episcopalians. The reason I say that is because Episcopalians, by and large, don't really believe in real resurrection. A lot of them probably accept the fact that mankind and creatures evolved. They don't believe in the miraculous. So they've kind of flushed all that. And they just kind of got this religion. I'm not saying this is true of all Episcopalians. I'm sure there are aspects of the Anglican Church and Episcopalians that are conservative. I know for a fact that there are. But by and large, they've given this up. Well, that's what the... And yet, they still have all this liturgy that they do. In fact, I've listened to one people say that... I don't know how it went. The wife was Episcopalian, the husband was Catholic, or vice versa. And so they would take turns going to each other's church with each other. And they said, you know, there's only a couple places in which our liturgy is different. Other than that, it's like being in the same service just about. And yet, the Catholic Church still affirms the miraculous, still affirms the resurrection. And the Episcopalian Church, they give lip service to that. But they don't really believe that. I remember years ago, I met an Episcopalian minister that was working as a chaplain in a hospital. And I happened to be reading a paper on substitutionary atonement. He goes, what's substitutionary atonement? Well, it's the idea that when Christ died on the cross, he was a substitute in place of us for all mankind, for our sins. Because they never heard of such a thing. And I said, well, involved the resurrection. He was just like, wow. He goes, you guys really believe in the resurrection and all this stuff? He's an Episcopalian minister working to help people in the hospital and such. But anyway, they're the comparable to that. They're concerned. The Sadducees are concerned about the ritual, but they don't really believe any of it in terms of anything supernatural. We know that because the Bible tells us they don't believe in a resurrection. So, Jesus says in chapter 23, verse 1, then Jesus spoke to the multitude and the disciples, saying, the scribes and the Pharisees have seated themselves in the chair of Moses. Therefore, all that they tell you, do and observe, but do not according to their deeds, for they say, but they do not do them. In other words, if they're really teaching you Moses, because they sit in the chair, do it, they obey it, but don't act like them, is what he's saying, because they don't actually do what Moses said. Verse 4, for they tie up heavy loads, lay them on men's shoulders, but they're not willing to even move, not even a finger. But they do all these deeds to be noticed by men, for they broaden their phylacteries and lengthen the tassels, and they love the place of honor at banquets and the chief seats in the synagogues and respectful greetings in the marketplaces and being called by men rabbi. Do not be called rabbi, for one is your teacher. You are all brothers. Do not call anyone on earth your father, for there's one is your father, he who is in heaven. And do not be called leaders, for one is your leader, that is Christ. See, they liked all these, they required all these things of these people. And he's trying to get at the fact that here are these people, with all the things that they were doing, they in the end are going to reject Jesus Christ. So if you go back over to Zechariah then, this is how I understand verse 8. Then when he says that I annihilated the three shepherds in 1 month, I believe he's looking at the fact that he's wiping out these three divisions. Now, that's not saying that there were nobody that were priests afterwards. There was nobody who were Sadducees, nobody who were Pharisees. But there were a lot of them that fell in the fall of Jerusalem. And Jerusalem was not the only place that fell in the process. Okay. And it says, for my soul was impatient with them, and their soul was weary of me. They had no time for him anymore. Now, who are they? Who do they have no time with? Well, we're still getting there. I told you I think it's the Messiah, but we'll see it in just a minute. Then I said, I will not pass to you. What is it? What is to die? Let it die. What is to be annihilated? Let it be annihilated. And let those who are left eat one another's flesh, which is indeed what ended up happening in the city. It's what happened when the city was under siege for 2.5+ years under Titus down there in Jerusalem, that there was cannibalism that went on within the walls of the city. So in other words, he reached a point with the people of Israel, which he goes, fine. Remember, just as he said back up in verse 6, I have no pity with the people in the land. He reaches a point in which, that's it. I'm done with you. Now, is God permanently done with Israel? No, because we know Paul says in Romans chapter 11, God has not thrown away his people. But he has set them over here on the shelf while he is engaged with something that he's doing with all mankind in terms of the church. Okay? He's taken out from all nations a people for himself. The church hasn't replaced Israel. Israel's put over here and God's focusing on this work. When he's done with this, then he resumes what he's doing with Israel. Okay? And so he says, verse 10, I took my staff favor, I cut it up in pieces, or delightful. In other words, delight, because he's not going to find desirable or delightful the people of Israel anymore. So he cuts that one up, to break my covenant which I had made with all the people. Now, we have a question here, is he referring to actually one of the specific covenants that God had made? this could be what's called over in the book of Leviticus the Palestinian covenant. Or is it the book of Deuteronomy? I'm trying to remember the Palestinian covenant's at. Which was a covenant which God promised them that when you obey the law, you get to dwell in the land. When they disobey the law and don't do what they're supposed to, guess what? Don't get to be in the land. So they break the covenant, and God gets to break the covenant with them. What he's doing. So it was broken on that day, and thus the afflicted of the flock who were watching me realized that it was the word of the Lord. And the word watching, if you have a New American Standard Bible, is the word guarding. And literally, it's not they're watching or guarding me, they're guarding for me. So in other words, he's looking at a time where you're going to have the afflicted in the land are people that are actually trying to guard the law. They're trying to do the right thing. And when it happens, they're going to go, this is God. They're going to recognize it. The rest of them, the rest of these people in the land, the people that don't care about one another, the people up there that fall into one, you don't want to fall into the power or authority of your neighbor because they might do you wrong. They might take advantage of you. They might sell you out. As we said back there, they'll sell you and say, hey, God made me rich. You want those kind of people? So there's a difference. So you have a contrast here between, we might say, the righteous in Israel and the bulk of them, which are unrighteous at the time he's referring to. And I think if you're not seeing this, we're looking that a lot of what he's looking at here in chapter 11 is looking forward to what the culmination of what's going to happen with the rejection of Jesus Christ and the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD. So he goes on in verse 12, and I said, if it is good in your sight, give me my wages. But if not, never mind, or let it go. So they weighed out 30 pieces of shekels, some of your Bibles have, of silver as my wages. Which, what did they pay for Judas to betray Jesus? 30 pieces of silver. The book of Exodus tells us that 30 pieces of silver was what you paid to redeem a slave, or a slave to be redeemed. So it was the price of a slave.
Exodus what?
Exodus. Let me find it here for you. Exodus 21:32. I bet if you had looked in your chain references in your Bible, you probably have it there. But Exodus 21:32 tells us that 30 pieces of silver was the price for a slave. It's what you valued them at. If a slave was, something happened with a slave, then that's what you had to do to pay for that.
So many thousands of years later, the shekel would still be worth of what it was, you know, thousands of years prior.
Well, see, they're putting shekel in here, but in the New American Standard, but it doesn't say that it's actually a shekel. It's just 30 of silver. Okay, yeah. And a shekel is a weight, by the way. So you had a coin that represented weight, but a shekel technically it was a weight value of money, as opposed to pulling out a $50 bill. Okay. So he asks for his wages. And then the Lord said to me, throw it to the potter, that magnificent price at which I, notice, Jehovah was valued. So the one that is shepherding is paid the money. But what's the value? It's the value that they put on the shepherd. And who's the shepherd, according to verse 13? Jehovah himself is the shepherd, telling you that this is Messiah. This is another one. I'm keeping a tally of these in one of my Bibles, places in which you have implications of a trinity, or at least a bi-unity in this case, because you only have two persons here for sure. You don't have the Spirit, but you get the point. But I'm keeping a list, and this is one of the ones I've added to it, where you actually have two persons. You have the Father in verse 4 that I believe speaks, and then you have Jehovah speaking in verse 13, and actually all through this context being God, the Son, the Shepherd, the Messiah. So he says, throw it to the potter, that magnificent price at which I was valued by them. So I took the 30 of silver and threw them to the potter in the house of the Lord. Now the significance of this is when he's talking about throw it to the house of the potter, there's two possibilities in this. For some people, the term potter was equivalent to throw it to the dogs. Because a potter was, because they worked in the mud and everything, it was considered to be a dirty job. It was like, you're no better than the dogs. But there was another aspect about it in which the potter was considered to be a low menial labor job, which I can't appreciate because from my point of view, when I tried to throw pots, it's hard. It takes skill to learn how to throw pots. But they considered a potter to be a low menial job. Okay, it was not considered a job of significance. And therefore, throwing it to the potter was actually saying, here, I'm the shepherd in charge of the whole flock of Israel, and the value you put on me is somebody that makes pots. That's how important you think I am.
It's also, does it go to Romans 9, potter of the clay?
No, no, that's a different emphasis in that context, yes.
So fast forward to Judas' betrayal. Didn't they call it the Potter's Field?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
That's weird. Yeah. They're not for sure if there's two ways it could have been the Potter's Field. It could have been the Potter's Field because it was a field that a potter had owned that Judas bought. Or it could have been a field that had a lot of clay that a potter owned because that's where he went out and dug up his clay that he would clean up and make. But they're not for sure exactly to which it refers. But yeah, so what ends up happening is this ends up being fulfilled very plainly and very clearly then in what happens to Jesus Christ. And so as a result of that, verse 14, then I cut my second staff, union in pieces. Because the union of, here in this case, God with his people or the shepherd with the sheep is being severed. This is cut in pieces to break the brotherhood now between Judah and Israel. Now, Israel and Judah had been broken up and separated quite a few years before this, almost 200 years prior to the time that Zechariah is prophesying. But that union then that they've had here with God, this union of Israel and Judah, is now broken up. So, first of all, they're cast out of their land, so the rod of favor or pleasantness is cut, and their union is separated because they're taken out. The union ceases to be. So verse 15, and the Lord said to me, take again for yourself the equipment of a foolish shepherd. For behold, I'm going to raise up a shepherd in the land who will not care for the perishing. Seek the scattered, heal the broken, or sustain the one standing, but will devour the flesh of the fat, tear off their hooves. Woe to the worthless shepherd who leaves the flock. A sword will be on his arm and on his right eye. His arm will be totally withered and his right eye will be blinded. Now I'm going to give you two possibilities on what this shepherd is that he's referring to here. Both of them are looking at a shepherd in the future. Now, one of them was a shepherd, a Jew that became a political leader for Israel after the fall of Jerusalem into the second century and tried to rally the people of Israel together and tried to, those few that were left around and tried to reunite them. But he ended up, in the process of reuniting him, he ended up doing it all for himself, and it ended up turning on the people, and the whole thing just went into a mess. I think the better, and I was taught that, I think the better understanding of this, in my opinion, and the one with a number of the commentators that I have some respect for, that they take this to be the beast that comes up in Revelation 13. Who starts up and he's their shepherd. Because initially, I turn over to Daniel 9 for a minute and take a look at what starts his reign? Peace. And if you look in Daniel chapter 9, look what this man does. Now, we're not going to go through all of this passage, but beginning in verse 24, he talks about the fact that there are 70 weeks or 70 sevens, he says, that have been declared for your people, your holy city, to finish the transgression, to make an end of sin, so on and so forth. And he comes down talking about the Messiah is going to be cut off in verse 26, and then the people of the prince of the people who is to come that are going to destroy the city. He's involved in this, and that man, that prince of the people, has come, which is one of the reasons we believe that this man, this beast, comes out of the people of Rome. So either out of the Roman Empire, or he is a Roman himself. Verse 27, it says, and he will make a firm covenant, modern day we'd call it a treaty, most likely, with many for 1 week. So it's not just with Israel, it's for the many, for 1 week. So, one period of 7 years, But in the middle of the week, or in the middle of that period of seven, he will put a stop to sacrifice grain offerings and on the wings of an abomination. Now, he's going to do something different than Antiochus Epiphanes. We talked about Antiochus Epiphanes last week in chapter 9. Antiochus Epiphanes, he made an abomination in the temple by going, taking an image of Zeus and setting it on top of the Ark of the Covenant. This man, according to Paul, you don't get it in the Old Testament, but Paul tells you what he does is he actually is going to go in and he's going to sit down in the throne of God and claim that he is God. So he's going to march into the Holy of Holies, pull that curtain aside, and sit down on top of the Ark. And he's going to say, I'm God. Because remember, where did God dwell as far as the people of Israel? Between the cherubim, above the lid of the Ark. So in that space, you got those cherubs up there, and he's right here. So if this is the lid, he's right there. He's not 20 feet up. He's not 10 feet up. He's right there between the wings of the cherubs. And this man's going to come in and sit there. How he's going to do that? It's not that big of a deal. And as a result, it's going to cause destruction. But the important point in understanding this is the thing that makes him known is that he's the one that makes this covenant that's for 7 years. For a week, a period of seven. But he breaks it in the middle. See, so at the beginning, he starts off as Israel's friend. He makes a covenant. And anybody that's paid any attention in the news to Israel over the last many years, since the 40s when they went back to the land, you can see there's just been trouble between Israel and the nations that are around it. And you can imagine, what would it be like if you had a man that was able to come along and broker a peace treaty, a 7-year peace treaty between Israel and all these other peoples, and bring about peace? Now, he's going to bring about peace by the sword. We know that because Revelation 6 tells us that this time starts with a person in white that goes out to conquer and conquering. So he has to conquer people to bring about this peace. So it's not like this peace treaty is just brokered by getting people to sit down and have talks with them, like they did with Camp David Accords and all these, or all these different treaties that have been made. Anyway, what? Yeah, this is one in which he actually is going to come in, and I think by military force he's going to establish this peace.
So an angel of God's going to.
No, the first of the four horsemen is a man and a white horse that goes out conquering and to conquer. Now that's a condition, is what it is. So what he's saying is that it starts with conquering, and that's the way this man begins bringing peace, and which is exactly what Jesus Christ wanted. They're going to say peace and safety, and then sudden destruction comes on them.
So he's going to be leading his military. The beast is going to be leading his military conquest, and then he's going to broker this peace deal.
Yeah, and I think he's going to use the military conquest to actually enforce this peace, is what he's going to do.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Anyway. And then in the middle of it, so the Israel thinks they've got a friend. Hey, look at this. We've got a shepherd. We've got a guy looking out for us. And they get their temple built and everything like that. And then once their temple's built and everything's going, he marches on in there and sits down. Now, he doesn't just... I don't know, I'm going to say be fair with him, but to help you get the full picture, the reason it happens is Revelation tells us he suffers a mortal wound and comes back to life. So in other words, he's killed in battle right about the midpoint of the tribulation. He comes back to life, and when he comes back to life after being killed, however he's killed, he apparently thinks, I'm undefeatable. I'm God. And he walks on into the temple and sits down and claims he is God.
Do we have any... insight as to whether the beast understands that he's empowered by Satan?
I think he does know that there's an empowerment from Satan, because Second Thessalonians 2 does indicate that his work and everything he does is by Satan. And when you go over to the book of Revelation, there's evidence there. Satan is involved in this. So I think this man in somewhere or another knows that Satan's involved. I don't think he's just a puppet out there that is ignorant of this, because he's held very accountable for what he does. Remember, the beast and the false prophet are the first one that are thrown in the lake of fire. No one's in the lake of fire until the beast and the false prophet get thrown in. Okay. Anyway, I'm just telling you, in Zechariah 11, those last two verses, I think that's the foolish shepherd. I think that that's what he's referring to. I realize not everybody agrees with the fact. I've got a good friend that doesn't believe that that's who it is. But I think that that's who this is. I think it makes the most sense. So, what have we gone over tonight? In a nutshell, chapter 10 is talking about a time in the future in which Israel is going to be regathered, in which they're going to be powerful, in which they're actually going to return from their captivity and have strength. Chapter 11 is talking about a future judgment that I believe is going to happen with the connection with the rejection of Jesus Christ as the king, and then the destruction that takes place in 70 AD, and how God is going to judge Israel's shepherds then. Their different leaders, pictured as I said, the trees, shepherds, and the lions. Okay, that's the way I understand that, and I think that's right. And then ultimately from there, he connects that then with the prophecy. Part of the reason this happens is because the value that these people give to him, this 30 pieces, the work of a potter is what you pay this great leader of the people. I mean, could you imagine if you had a president that really did a great job, really got the economy on track and didn't raise your taxes and really got things in order and did all this, and then they said, in fact, what we're going to do is my salary, you pay me whatever you think I'm worth. And you said, well, how about 2 cents and you can go buy yourself some Bazooka Joe bubble gum? Because when I was a kid, 2 cents, you could get a piece of Bazooka Joe bubble. I mean, you'd look at the guy and go, that's what you think I'm worth? You think I'm worth that? Maybe that puts that in perspective. I don't know if it's a good example, but you get the idea. Or this is what I pay my paper boy here, you know. That maybe it'd be more appropriate anyway. So that's what's going on. And then at the end, there is going to be a shepherd they are going to follow. And he's going to be one that is actually, in terms of the way he operates and such, he's a foolish shepherd. So
at the end of chapter 10, when there's a future scattering, we talked about, you know, like verse 9, chapter 10, verse 9. So is that scattering still to come? Is that going to be true?
I believe that's the scattering that actually is on right now. Okay. That's happened since the time of 70 AD when all of them have been scattered. And there's been some Israelites that have gone back to the land of Israel at the present time, but still most of the Jews are still outside the land.
Yeah. So when the beast sits down on the mercy seat to the Son of God, that's going to cause a bit of a...
What actually Revelation says is going to happen is that it's going to cause Israel then to flee. And Jesus says that when you see the abomination spoken of Daniel sitting in the holy place. So he tells you right where it's going to be at. It's going to be in the Holy of Holies. He says, then you flee. And they're going to flee to the southeast, and they're going to be divinely protected. God's going to divinely protect those people that flee out there. So, and they're going to flee out there. I don't know where they're going to go. Everybody says they're going to go to Petra. I don't know if they'll go to Petra. God says he's got a place prepared for them. So I don't know. They could go to Petra and God could prepare. You know, like I said, in years past, Petra seemed like a very impenetrable fortress. But today, yeah, you can fly over that thing and drop bunker buster bombs in there. And you know, you take care of that short order, the people would all be under a pile of rubble. They might be safe inside a cave that's dug way back in there, but that doesn't mean any good if you don't have food and a lot of fresh air coming in. It takes not natural protection, but divine protection. But there's also the possibility that with the things that go on, maybe there won't be air warfare back at that time. Mm-hmm. Maybe planes will all be grounded because there won't be any fuel to fly them with.
I mean, all literally using animals with the 2 million coming.
Yeah, it does refer to 2 million, yeah, people, armies coming on horses and things like that. So, yeah, exactly. So, just to answer a few questions on the back of your sheet then, because we do have several questions here. See if you can answer. Question number one, from whom were Israel to ask for rain back in chapter 10? He said, verse 1, ask rain from
the Lord.
So they're asked from Jehovah. And how is this related to the teraphim? Teraphim, remember, were their false household idols. And could the false household idols give them rain?
No.
But it was actually resorting to those, and this is what you're relating it to. He's encouraging these people. You continue asking from him. Don't, what he's getting at is, don't be like your fathers that asked these idols. He's amazing. He doesn't say that directly, but that's what they've done. That's what got them in trouble. Okay. Second question. Explain the following these. The cornerstone, the nail, slash peg, or the bow. Who's the cornerstone? Messiah. That actually is going to lead them. The nail or peg, which I said was used by J.L., the wife, I can't remember his name right now, put it through the Sisera, through the temple of Sisera, commander of the Canaanite army. And then the bow, just as in back in 9:13, is God actually bending Ephraim, bending the people here, bending them to use them to, in other words, God's going to take these people that are seem very weak and impoverished, and he's going to make them powerful. And he, of course, it starts with him being the cornerstone of all this. Next one. What does 10:6 through 12 state that God will be doing? And in 6 through 12, in 10:6 through 12, he's talking about the reunification of Israel and Judah. He's talking about the returning them from an exile, returning them from scattering. So this is when he brings them back. And again, it implies another, from the time they're at. These two guys returned from exile. They haven't been back that long, and it's implying you're going to be exiled again. I think this is being written around 520, and I always have to look back on my little chart here.
That's an incredible feat. If you figure out airfare and whatnot today to get all the Jews back there.
Yeah.
It's very expensive to move across country like that. So, but God can make you move. Just we got to get out of here. But it's supernatural.
Yep. In 11:6, in 11:6, we asked, who is the king? It says his king, and why do we think that's the case? Remember? No, in verse 6, it says, for I shall no longer have pity on the inhabitants of Israel, declares the Lord, but behold, I shall cause the men to fall each into another's power and into the power of his king. Caesar. Caesar. And why is that the case? Because they rejected God's king. They rejected Christ. We have no king but Caesar. John 19:15. There, I've got the verse written down there. And then I asked you to identify, if you could, the threefold leadership in chapter 11 and verse 8. The threefold leadership. We have the three shepherds. What were the
three
shepherds, young lions, which compare to Pharisees, priests, Sadducees. Okay.
I had a question before, and I didn't answer. Waiting to see if it answers.
Okay. And what was significant about the wages of the shepherd? There were a couple of things that were significant about it. Yeah, and it was the price of a slave. Yeah, as the treated like the wage of a potter. Very insignificant. Okay. And then that also goes on and explains the thought about the potter, that a potter was considered like a low wage job. Okay. When I was a kid, from fourth grade until I was a freshman in high school, I had a paper route. That's a low wage job. Make about $20 every 2 weeks, and you gotta go out 7 days a week every morning for about an hour, and you get paid. It was, yeah. But you didn't make much money. So, well, let's have a word of prayer.